I'm Jamie.
And I'm Beth. Welcome to Thief Steals the Podcast.
Where I steal the podcast.
And I steal it back.
Okie dokies, today we are talking about the 16th episode of the 4th season, The Gold Job. Beth, what did you think?
I loved this episode.
I am so glad.
It was so fun. It was so, like, I mean, it was an episode of Leverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was also breaking the pattern of an episode of was having a ball.
We get sort of our first glimpse of Hardison as mastermind, something that he's been gunning for since like the second season.
Yeah, he is the puppet master now.
No, that's Hang Loose.
I'm sure you know Hang Loose, but not how to high five. No, I really liked this episode. Hardison is everything.
Mm-hmm.
I adore him. Like, when he is fucking having a crack and being like, you don't understand or appreciate how much I fucking do. Like, I do weeks of work for every con. Y'all wouldn't last a day without me. And then the whole, like, sort of extended bit of them not being able to use the computer. Love it.
My favorite bit of that entire sequence, though, is then when they get to, like, you know, Parker's pulling the heist. She's breaking into the safe.
Oh my God, yes.
And he's like, mentally, I'm not here. I'm on strike.
I know. I love that he's on strike. But also, I love that he's so dressed up this episode.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Oh, and what is very fun is that he makes a point tonight and he's like, who's going to help Parker carry out all those gold bars? They are heavy. And then you find out that he already knows that there are no gold bars. And I'm like,
he knows.
Little shit, I love you. He's everything to me. In this episode, he's everything.
Just
everything else is just Ken. Like, obsessed. Obsessed.
Here's the thing. I think sometimes they severely underutilize Hardison.
Mm-hmm.
Not this week.
No.
This week they're given Hardison everything. This entire time it's been like, oh yeah, no, like Hardison goes over the top. He does too much. Like, he can't just let something be simple.
We've seen this even in every single time that he does, like, a performance to, like, distract a mark or to, like, get access to somewhere. It's always, like, a stereotype that he over-the-top.
It's at the core of his character. And we get, like, and this is why back in the Scheherazade job, like, he was like, I want to run my own crew one day. Tell me what you do. This is exactly what Nate was getting at.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so convoluted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's actually, like, a really... really good example of, like, personally, I find it very frustrating when you sometimes have a dynamic where there's an older person basically telling a younger person, like, you don't know how the world works, you're too young and naive. Like, there is legitimacy there,
mm-hmm.
but I often dislike the way it's presented because I find it very reductive for a younger person's experience because it feels very dismissive. And I kind of don't like the inverse either, which is where you have the younger person being like, you don't understand how the world works anymore because you don't know how to use computers.
It's like, changed.
Yeah. And I'm like, I think that there is validity on both sides of that, but I generally dislike how it's presented because it typically comes across as like antagonistic and dismissive. And I'm like, no, no, both parties have points.
Yeah.
Like, the older person does have more experience and, like, has that retrospective, like, way of looking at things and also have had the opportunity to learn from their mistakes, and younger people have not had that. But there is truth in saying that younger people tend to have a better idea of how society is currently functioning because they are on the tipping point of it, like, mm-hmm. at the cutting edge of technology, like, they've grown up with it, like, they have a more thorough understanding. Like, there are valid points on both ends. I think that this episode did a really good job of showing both Hardison and Nate's different perspectives and also how both of them have incredible strengths in those perspectives. Because Nate is shown to really struggle with the tech side of things. He is shown to have difficulty doing Hardison's work. Hardison is shown to struggle with just the basics of what Nate does.
Yeah.
Like, it does a fantastic job of highlighting how neither of them could do the other's job as effectively as they would just normally do it. And it does it in a way where neither of them are being unnecessarily fucking rude about it.
They're both right.
Yeah.
But most importantly, they're both wrong.
Yeah.
And they're both, it's like equal and opposite ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hardison underestimates the importance that experience and sort of that wisdom that comes with age.
Yeah.
But also Nate underestimates exactly how much the new technology side of it he's come to rely on.
Mm-hmm. Without actually understanding how it works. And even Sophie points out, she's like, we appreciate what you do. We don't understand a lot of it, but we appreciate it. And I was like, yeah, that's the point. You actually, you can't fully appreciate it because you don't understand it.
And also because I think this goes for like every episode of Leverage, Hardison makes it look easy because he's so good. It just looks so easy and so flawless. And like he's and
in the same line. Yeah. So does Nate.
Mm-hmm.
Nate makes it look easy because he's so good. And so like the two of them are watching each other and thinking, I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be that fucking hard. They can do it. I can do it. But they can't.
Yeah.
Because the important thing is that they need to have both of their perspectives. They need to have both sides of that coin to cooperate, and that's what makes the team function.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, like at the moment, we're specifically talking about Nate and Hardison, but Sophie, Parker, and Elliot are just as important.
Yes.
It's just that for the sake of this discussion, those two being opposite sides of the coin.
I just want to say here, if we take season one, Beth, and we put her in this conversation, how do you think she would feel that you finally see what Nate does?
She would be so upset. But I hate that I enjoy this dynamic. I hate that I'm giving validity to Nate and his stupid hat. He again is wearing a hat this episode. Yes. You know, like, the thing is,
I think we can assume this episode, though, that the Nate stupid hat is Hardison's decision.
Well, what's interesting is that the hat that Nate is wearing, it's like that cat beret kind of style, which if we ever see Hardison wearing a hat,
is that stuff?
That's the style of the hat. I cannot believe that when I started making jokes about Nate's hats, like I really...
But the key thing is it's not a Nate hat. It's a Hardison hat. So let's say thank you to Nadine Haters for her smart and clever costuming.
While we're thanking Nadine for things, one, Hardison looked fly as fuck in every single episode to the point where people in the episode were like, you look good. And he was like, I know. Okay, but also Sophie at one point was wearing this like black shirt with like a little slit across the top. Amazing, impeccable. She looked stunning. And Parker was wearing this little cute like collared shirt with like this little like sort of very thin floppy string bow tie situation. And that was so cute. Like
I also wanted to say special shout out
for Elliot and glasses
and Parker's fucking antiques dealer outfit.
Oh my god, yes.
And with a little like headscarf
and like, that she was wearing. And oh, loved it. Loved it.
Yeah. I feel like we shout out Nadine Haters, like not infrequently, but like it just goes baseline for every episode. So like this is the reminder that like, yeah, no, we are constantly thanking Nadine Haters. Because here's the thing. I know that a lot of the creatives on Leverage, like most of them are pretty consistent. Like most of them worked on all five seasons. Like a few come and went, but like most of them worked on all five seasons. Nadine Haters was the costume designer for every single episode of Leverage. Mm. She went nowhere. She did all five seasons and...
Is she doing the reboot?
No, she didn't do the reboot. Okay. But she did all five seasons of the original Leverage. And I think what gets me is it's like Leverage is sort of this silly, fun little show. And from like a costuming perspective, there shouldn't be anything overly remarkable about it. But Nadine Haters somehow puts in so much thought and just consideration to the costumes that every week I'm blown away by just how good they are at characterizing the characters.
Do you know what's really funny? It's like as much as over on Supernatural we talk about how each individual writer is really interesting and like any of them that sort of... exist there for a long period of time, you can really see their style and like the things they typically do and focus on. Nadine Haters feels like the Leverage equivalent because we don't really talk about the individual writers on Leverage very much.
No.
But Nadine Haters, like you can see her in the show. You can see like with the hats. The hats cannot be a thing that were just included in the script. Like maybe like they put in there like, oh, Nate's wearing a disguise or whatever.
It might have been like a costuming decision made with like the director of the week.
Yeah.
But like Nadine would be the one who was constantly bringing it back.
The ongoing symbolism of it is so interesting. Or like the fact that Hardison always like, he very often will wear like a neck scarf kind of situation. Yeah. The style of clothes that Sophie favors, like the fact that they're always very slim cut and sleek and stylish, like it is so perfectly suited to the type of cons that she runs, like she specifically runs. When she's in meetings with the team, she'll often be wearing like a flowy blouse kind of thing. Like she's more relaxed, it's more casual, but it's still nice.
Yeah.
But when she is on a con, so rarely is she wearing anything that isn't skin tight. Like, and it's so, like the fact that we've talked before, like Sophie plays on people's like heartstrings and stuff. Like a lot of the time she's flirting her way through situations. That is so evident just in the costuming alone. Like the fact that Parker is always wearing clothes that are flexible and like, you know, often it breaks down to like a top piece and a bottom piece. We very rarely see her wear like one piece dresses or anything because they're impractical. The only time she ever wears them was when it's essential to the plot that she'd be wearing it. And then even then she often has a change. Like, to something more practical. My only note on Parker is that she has her hair down too often, but I can't really
that's say not Nadine's that fault.
Because that's just part of women in film. They don't get to put their hair up. And honestly, if I don't hold it against Sam in Supernatural, I can't hold it against Parker here. But it is so funny to me because have you ever heard of the Dungeon?
No.
It's literally a warehouse from the Supernatural, like, costume department. And it's just jeans.
What?
It's so funny. It's literally just denim.
Why?
Because there was so little variation in their costuming ever. Like, there are, like, very key moments you can think of where either Sam or Dean, or even Cass, for that matter, or Crowley, are wearing anything that isn't, like... Like, if I told you to imagine what Dean looked like, you're imagining one of two things, denim and some kind of layered jacket with plaid underneath, probably maybe like a black shirt, right? Or one of the like FBI suits, right?
It was the plaid.
Yeah. Okay. One of two things though. There are very few circumstances where any of our main cast are wearing anything that isn't just a variation of those two things.
Typically notable when they're wearing something other than that.
Yeah.
I will say though.
What?
To be fair, the Supernatural.
Yeah.
Doesn't lend itself to variation in costuming the same way Leverage does. Leverage is just remarkable in that.
Right.
Because every week it's completely different plots.
Right. But it's so funny to me that it's like the Supernatural writers are like this very trackable, like whatever thing. And the Leverage writers just aren't. But the Leverage costuming is. Mm-hmm. And the Supernatural costuming, again, there are like specific things we can get into. Like at a certain point we have Dean's red shirt of bad decisions.
Yeah.
We'll get there. But, you know, and their emotional baggage bags.
What's so funny but, is like, we will get to it, but Elliot, there is a fandom joke about Elliot's red shirt of good decisions.
Oh, that's so funny.
As in, he's making good decisions, but everyone else around him is making bad decisions when he wears it.
Dean's is the exact inverse.
I think we have like a notable, we have a notable example coming up in the next couple of episodes.
Oh, fun. We can come back to it.
Yeah, I'll point it out because it is a piece of symbolic costuming, and yes, it is Elliot in a red shirt.
Oh, speaking of symbolism, I have a question for you. Leverage very rarely does anything for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And this episode, they went out of their way to stage a storm, like a thunder lightning storm, during Hardison's like initial explanation of the con, which we kind of flash back to throughout the episode. I have to assume that that was symbolic of something. I don't know if it was symbolic of like Hardison creating the perfect storm kind of thing. Like, I'm not sure, like maybe if I have interpreted it correctly, but like to me, there is no way that that is not a specific choice that was made with an artistic intent. Because the last time we saw it was the murder mystery thing, and like the thunder was like, and lightning was explicitly important.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting that you bring up, you know, the murder mystery episode, because I think that's also another episode that really bucks the, like, the general sort of plot. And obviously I can't say too much because we're going into the season finale after, like, we've got the two-part season finale after this one. But I think it is also important as we go into the season finale to, think back on that episode. So it may even just be they're trying to remind you of that earlier episode.
Okay, if that's the case, they definitely did. But to be fair, they reminded me of it, and I'm a person who was actively mm-hmm. looking to yep. dissect this show.
Other than that, I think it's also just the point is they're in Portland and Portland has bad weather.
Like, I literally would not have known that if you hadn't just told me. So
we're also not American.
Yeah, okay. But like...
Portland's really rainy.
Oh, yeah. Like Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But yeah, no, I think that it is interesting to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
Like specifically because it's not just rain. Like, it is thunder and lightning, which is much more dramatic.
Yeah.
And
I'm assuming that set was on a soundstage. So it's like, if they didn't want it to sound like thunder, like, it's not just...
It's not like that was just conveniently happening outside. Like, no.
No.
Also, I feel like, I mean, maybe it was just to kind of accompany, like, the theatrics of everything that Hardison was doing. Like, maybe it's just, like... And also, the weather is dramatic to match the dramatic tone. Yeah.
Could just be like, and it could just be the vibes of the scene are internally, because Hardison is essentially staging a coup overnight.
I do. I didn't think about it like that, but you're so right.
Because, you know, and this episode does talk a lot about strikes. And
Oh, it's so topical. Not that it will be by the time we're releasing this because of the strike.
Yeah. But it's interesting that, you know, Hardison is saying, I'm going to withhold my labor until you let me basically take your job, which is obviously not typically what strikes are
about. But
it is something that, you know, Hardison has been pretty vocal about gunning for since season one, season two. Like, this is something that he's always said, like, he wants to run his own crew one day.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that since he's been saying, I want to run my crew one day,
mm-hmm.
Nate has been saying, yeah, that's probably a bad idea.
Yeah. And, like, I think this kind of comes back to what I was saying before about me liking the dynamic they went with Hardison and Nate in this episode. I appreciate that, particularly that final scene that closes out the episode.
Yeah.
Where it felt like a very paternal moment. Yeah. For Nate, particularly, you know, like, and he does the feedback form or the evaluation, whatever the fuck you want to call it. And, like, I know that he would have given genuine feedback. Yeah. Like, and that's why Hardison thanks him.
Yeah.
Because, like, if he was just going to write, like, a comical, like, A plus or whatever, like, it would accomplish nothing. Yeah. It would not actually be constructive. And knowing Nate as a character, I personally think that he probably put genuine ratings and construction on there so that Hardison can learn and grow.
Yes.
In a way that's like explicitly supportive. Mm. Like, it's not like I'm going to tear you down.
Yeah, no. Nate is a fantastic father figure for Parker.
Mm.
They meld in a way that is weird. Very...
like, it's specifically too perfect.
Yeah. Like, they... The two of them just, like, you know, she is the perfect daughter to his perfect father.
Mm-hmm.
He's not so good with Elliot Hardison. Like, if we're looking at, you know, the found family, Nate, Sophie, mum and dad, the other three and the kids. Prior to this, he's been a pretty bad paternal figure to specifically Hardison and Elliot, while he's been a weirdly perfect father figure for Parker.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, they all have different emotional needs and Nate is, in fact, also a repression boy, which is why I was shocked that you didn't like him so much in the first season. But, you know, so it's sort of this thing of it is a unique moment that we have this episode where we start to see Nate realize what Hardison needs.
Mm-hmm.
Because up till this point, he's been treating Hardison the same way he treats Parker. And that's great for Parker because she reacts really well to that sort of paternal
role.
She reacts really nicely to it. And I think that's, you know, it's part of a side effect of she was basically raised by Archie. And it's like Archie cared about her, but like Nate is more likely to show it. But also she doesn't expect the same things out of familial or paternal relationships that someone like Elliot or Hardison would, who had more traditional...
Especially, like, Hardison was raised by, like, Nana or, like, you know, so it was clearly a more maternal...
Yeah.
Obvious. I would suggest it lends itself to the view. Like, we... Mm-hmm. Because we've met Archie and we've heard Hardison talk about Nana a few times, I get the vibe that Nana probably never said to Hardison that he wasn't real family.
Yeah.
You know?
No.
Like, I get the vibe.
Those aren't the vibes.
Yeah.
At all. So it's, like, it's really interesting to see that Nate is starting to realize that what Hardison needs is inherently different to what Parker needs.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just so happened to perfectly work out for him and Parker, but it's not working out for him and Hardison. So he sort of has to change his tactics. He has to change his standpoint.
Mm. Yeah, you have to be able to shift your tactics depending on which kid you're working with. Yeah, I mean, it would be like being a teacher or a parent of multiple children. Mm-hmm. Like, just because one kid responds well to something doesn't mean it's going to respond well to the other. And it's like, do you ever have like a teacher or like a lecturer or whatever through like school or uni where they just have a teaching style that just doesn't gel for whatever fucking reason, and you're like, I'm not understanding this concept.
Yeah.
Can you please explain it? And like literally they just keep telling the same words at you over and over, and you're like, okay, but I'm not getting it.
Yeah.
So could you explain it in literally any other way? And they just can't. Mm-hmm. Like they don't know how to adapt their teaching style to any need that isn't covered by their teaching style. Mm-hmm. It feels like that. Yeah. Like, Nate is learning, like, oh, Hardison is not understanding how much I appreciate his work. He's not getting the feedback that he needs.
Yeah.
I've been giving him Parker feedback, not Hardison feedback. Yeah. And I need to give him Hardison feedback. And so, like, I think also part of it, like, Hardison actually creating the evaluation form is him giving an indicator of the kind of feedback he wants. Like, he doesn't want to just be told, hey, you did good today.
Yeah.
He wants to be given constructive feedback so that he can take it and know where to work to do better next time.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that in terms of, like, if we're using, like, a parental relationship as an analogy here, I think that it was a really good example of Nate not being a helicopter parent, but also being there to catch Hardison when he falls.
Yes.
It's literally, like, when you take the training wheels off the bike for the first time and you can't just stand there with your arms around your child because then they can't ride the bike. You just have to let them go and they'll probably fall off, but you've given them a hard hat and...
It's the equivalent of putting on like knee pads and a helmet.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you've...
Making sure that you're doing it in a safe place where if they fall off, it's not the end of the world.
And you're on hand with some Band-Aids and, you know, like... And you just have to let them fall off the bike. And, like, it sucks because you don't want your child to get hurt. That's going to suck. You don't want them to lose the confidence that they've got. That's going to suck. But you've just got to let them do it so that they learn. And, you know, you just make the circumstance as controlled as you can so that you can account for the variables in a way that still makes them feel like they are in control and they're making the decisions and they still get to learn from the experience. And that's, like, essentially what's happening here. Like, Nate is letting Hardison make his own mistakes. Although, to be fair, he does struggle to let go of the reins initially. He
does.
And I'm glad that they make a point out of that.
I like that they make a point out of Nate is struggling to hand over the reins, but he also does.
Yeah, he does. And then he creates a backup plan because he can see the flaws, but he doesn't want to... be the helicopter parent being like, I'm not letting you take off the training wheels, or I'm going to stand there and like hold the handles as you pedal kind of thing. Like, no, he's like, I'm going to let you go. I know you're going to fall off, but I have Band-Aids ready to go.
Yeah.
And like, I think that that is the best way that Hardison is going to learn. He needs that practical experience.
Yeah.
To be able to build off of. And I, anyway, I'm rambling, but I just really liked it. I thought it was very well done. It felt like it was very nuanced. While also being very fun and in character.
The most fun and in character thing I think about the entire episode, though. Parker had a bite of every donut in the box because she had to work out which one she wanted.
Oh, and there was a donut with Fruit Loops on it. And I was like, that's cereal, baby. She's it still finding a way to eat cereal. Mm-hmm. And I was like...
Yep. Because that is the one that she ultimately chooses. Is the one with Fruit Loops on it.
Yep.
Cereal theory, man. It's real.
Oh, also, I fully, and I'm not, like, going to take, like, heaps of credit here because I don't think it was particularly, like, hidden, but I fully was like, oh, Nate is writing down his, like, predictions for this. He's already writing down what's going to happen or, like, how it's going to fail or whatever. It'll come back up at the end of the episode.
And then I think the things are, like, buy drill, do the
Yeah, like, he basically broke the con down to its absolute bare essentials.
You mean the double-pronged monkey con, which is a brand new 21st century con. That is the funniest thing to me, though, is when he's like, oh, that's just, this is where it gets complicated. And it, like, zooms out on this massive fuck-off, like flow chart of like everything that's happening simultaneously. And like,
I just realized something. When we write fic, you're Nate. I'm Artisan. Like, you're like,
I'm like,
this is what I'm doing. Yeah. I have a structure. It's just very straightforward. Yes. And I'm like, I've got a fucking timeline. It's going to be 500,000 words plus. It's going to take me 3 years and I have no idea where to start.
I'm like, I have a concept. I'm like, I'm writing a Great British Bake Off IU.
And it's so good. It's so fun.
I'm writing a Great British Bake Off IU. I'm like, okay, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to have two chapters.
Mm-hmm.
This is how they line up.
Mm-hmm. You have a structure.
I have a structure. I just put it in place and then I just follow the basic structure. If I want to add stuff, I'll add stuff. If I want to take stuff, I'll take stuff. I just go with the flow. Mm-hmm. You're like, I am plotting out.
I have the most over-convoluted plot of all time. I cannot wait for it to... I've actually nearly finished the first full chapter. And also I'm writing it out of order because I'm an idiot and because I'm writing it on a timeline that I'm going to tell it out of order. So then I have to come up with, like, within the first chapter that I'm writing is actually the fourth chapter in sequence. And I'm going to have to break up that chapter into date ranges because then I need the other chapters, because it's told out of order, to like say I start with like, oh, this is like the 1st of April. Then I need the next chapter. Actually, okay. So I'm starting with the fourth chapter, right? But then what I'm going to do is like, say it starts on the 1st of April. Then there's a section of the second chapter that is going to be on like the 5th of April, which is going to like, but you've already read the 5th of April before you get to the 1st of April. So it's like a whole thing. It's a whole thing, Jamie. And it's hard, but it'll be good when it's finished or it'll go to shit. And I won't finish it. But I believe in myself. I'm really attached to this one. I've nearly finished the fourth chapter.
What's so funny though is that you have actually been so net coded throughout this entire show. Now you're like, I'm just hard. Which, like, you are correct.
It's just so funny. Like, just because we were talking about our fix before, yeah. And I was like, oh shit.
I'm like,
I'm so overcomplicated this.
Yeah. We have very different tactics when it comes to writing fix.
Yeah. Yours is very
straightforward
and like to the point, and it's like so immediately impactful. And mine's like, I tried to explain Naomi is the only person who has got the full outline of my plot for this. It took me like the better part of an hour. And that was before I'd even fully fleshed it out.
I could literally explain to you the plot of all three of my fics in like 30 seconds. 15
minutes. Yeah.
Like, I feel like we take a very inherently different tactic. I think we also just add impact in different ways. You're like, I'm going to add impact because, like, I'm going to put in this reference and then 40 chapters later, I'm going to knock your socks off 100,000 words right by bringing it back. I'm like, I'm just going to, like, add some hints. I'm going to add some nudges. Like,
and then 500 words later.
Yeah. And then 500 words later, you're going to be emotionally devastated while it's still fresh. Like, you're kind of like, you know, pulling the knife out of the knife block and just leaving it on the table for a bit and then throwing it across the room into the bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like stabbing you with it and then twisting a little bit. You know what I mean?
That's such a fun analogy.
But you know what I mean?
Yeah, like
yours is about the anticipation.
I've put stuff in the fourth chapter that will not be relevant till like the 12th or 16th chapter. I can't remember what order I've got it in now, but
it's about being innocuous. It's about not even knowing that you're anticipating something and then it's stabbing you out of the body.
What's really hard is because I know what's going to happen. It feels stupid obvious to me. And I'm reading it going, oh, they're going to pick this and know what I'm going to do. No, you're not. It's really annoying. But anyway. Oh my God. Okay. I've got a nice tie-in. Yeah. It's literary.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. So number one. I'm obsessed with the fact that Hardison essentially just created the plot to his own National Treasure movie. Like, the only thing missing was Nicolas Cage. Like, quite genuinely. Like, they even reference the fucking Declaration of Independence in this episode. And I was just like, that's so funny. But number two, this episode so specifically reminded me of a book series that I had fully forgotten about. I can't even remember what it was called anymore. I used to get it from the Scholastic fucking...
Book fest?
Yeah. Well, no, not from the book fest, the magazines.
Mm.
Do you remember they just give them out? Mm-hmm. And, like, Mom did this thing where she was like, okay, Bethany, like, once a term, you can pick, like, a book.
Oh, wow. Highly luxury.
I know.
It was like a, because I just fucking read, like,
just tell us you are rich next time.
Yeah, sure. Me and my $10 every 12 weeks. No, so it was like, you know, because I used to just read through everything. I reread all of my books like fucking 30 times over. And mum was like, you can have one new book every fucking 12 weeks. And I'm like, okay. So there was this series and I used to get the next book in the series and it was taking me forever because it was like, you know, they're short books, they're kids' books.
Yeah.
But basically the plot was that this old dude had died, but he, in his will, he like gave the, all the family members an ultimatum. Either they could take $1 million straight out and just walk away, or they could play this like insanely convoluted, stupid treasure hunt that he'd like created to like get the mass of his fortune. So like the
I'm taking $1 million
and walking away. Right.
Like,
anyway,
how is that a question? Like, potentially get nothing and also waste a whole bunch of time doing a treasure hunt. And I'm assuming it was also a dangerous treasure hunt.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and all the family members are fucking insane. They're all literally willing to kill each other. The main protagonist was like fucking a 14-year-old girl and her like fucking uncle is like, I'm going to kill you. Like, what the fuck was I reading anyway? Like,
I'm taking $1 million.
At 14? Yeah, I'm 14, fucking off.
I'm taking $1 million. I'm buying myself a house for like half a mil of that.
Yeah, right. Anyway.
Like, I'm investing that shit and then like a decade later, I'll have fuck tons of money.
Literally.
And then it won't matter that I didn't play the stupid fucking treasure hunt.
It was the most insane. I think I probably still have the books at home. I might. Anyway, it was wild and it was what this episode made me think of. And I have not thought about this book series in God knows, probably the better part of the last 2 decades now. Like, you know, like probably in at least 15 years, I haven't thought about this book series, but
you know, it's a new 21st century con that is heavily reliant on video games, which makes perfect sense for Hardison as a character.
Mm-hmm. But it was like, honestly, so fun because it felt like every time the marks were interacting with them, it felt like when you interact with an NPC and they have like 3 possible responses kind of thing. It was so, like, it felt like a video game as they were playing it out. And I was like, I love this.
And I love the fact that he highlights, like, I almost got lost down here. Is like, but you didn't, did you? Because I specifically designed it using the same visual cues that you would see in something like a video game.
Yeah. It's great. Like, I love that he was not only reading the marks like a narrative, but he was just planning the con like a narrative. And, like, obviously, inevitably, it kind of fails. But it was such a good concept.
Yeah, it didn't really fail because of his plan. It failed because he doesn't have the experience to understand that, like, you know, as Sophie says, you don't need, like, a multi-day fucking elaborate as shit con to sign a land deal.
Mm-hmm. You need half a glass of champagne and a low-cut dress. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, he's just, because he's thinking like a hacker, like, and I think that's actually honestly what it comes down to at the end of the day. He's treating this con like it's a hack. He's controlling for all the variables. He's making, like, doing multi-pronged attacks. He's doing a lot of different individual things so they culminate into one thing. But what he's forgetting is that people aren't machines.
Yeah. People have emotions and they can get frustrated or annoyed or bored or, yeah.
He's not counting on the fact that, you know, the marks of the week are going to act like people.
Mm-hmm. Not NPCs.
Not NPCs. So it's sort of like, it's a really lovely demonstration of how, while Hardison is insanely smart, so smart, he's also very much in his own, like, mind and, like, everything that he does is filtered through his own experience. And his experience is primarily
the online,
digital tech stuff.
Yeah. And even Nate makes the point when they're sort of talking after it's all fallen through. And Nate is talking about, you know, you didn't anticipate the rage quit. And I love that they use this analogy because, again, I think it's a really good example of Nate changing tactics to explain this to Hardison in terminology and examples that he will understand. Because, yeah, the rage quit is the perfect way to sum up what has happened in this con and why it hasn't worked, why it's gone wrong. But it's doing it in a way that is making it relevant to Hardison's interests and relevant to Hardison's understanding of what he has created. Because Hardison didn't really create a con as much as he created an IRL video game.
Yes.
You know, like, he's basically created an open world escape room.
Yes. Like, he's, yeah. Basically what he's done is he's, yeah, he's, because he's approached it like a video game.
Mm.
He's just created a video game for the marks to play.
Yeah. It's like a sandbox. It's like basically he's put them in Breath of the Wild and let them run around. Like, but the problem with that is he's given them simultaneously too much and not enough freedom.
Yeah.
Like, because he's put them in a sandbox, mm-hmm. technically they can do whatever they want. But he's also trying to
control
them
do.
Like rats in a maze and funnel them down a particular mm-hmm. pipeline, which, granted, is what the team usually does, but not in this manner.
Normally, the control that Nate has over the marks is a lot tighter.
Mm-hmm.
Nate is there. He's anticipating exactly, because that's the key thing. At the end of the day, like, Nate and Sophie read the people.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they do is based on the people.
Yeah.
And, like, yes, Hardison hacked the online, you know, dating profile questionnaires to include psychology questions in there, but he understands it on an intellectual level.
But also, people aren't going to necessarily be answering online dating questionnaires
mm-hmm.
in a reliable manner.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, to be fair, psychology questionnaires aren't that hard.
They're not that reliable. Well, they're not that reliable anyway.
They're not that hard to pass, as Parker says.
Oh my God, that's such a funny line. I literally wrote
it down.
They're
not that hard. Sometimes I made my doctor's.
Yeah, I had a lot of psych exams as a kid. They're actually very easy, and I put in brackets, normal to want and possible to achieve.
I love that she adds the little detail that she did make a couple of her, like, psychologists cry a few times.
She's so funny. Like, she also had another line this episode where she goes, that's his very serious arm cross. Mm-hmm. And I cannot explain to you how funny that is to me personally, because there is a Destiel equivalent.
Of the very serious arm cross?
Literally, someone, like, it's Dean and Cass in a room, and the person they're talking to literally is like, is he serious? Or are you serious? And Cass looks at Dean and goes, yes, that's his serious face. And I was like, why is this the same?
It is really interesting because, yeah, like, fundamentally, Nate and Hardison just, they read people in different ways and they rely on different things. And, like, Hardison is coming from it, like, at it from a very intellectual standpoint. Like, he even says it's based on the most addictive psychology known to man, video mm-hmm. game design, which is great because video games are incredibly addictive. But I think he's missing the fundamental human element to video games.
Mm-hmm, which is, you're choosing, well, the point is they're supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
Number one. But also, you know when you're playing one.
Mm.
Like, it's very different. Like, if I personally was going to choose to play a horror game, for example, mm. right? Like, I don't know. I don't play games very much. But, you know, if I was going to choose to play, like, a Resident Evil game,
yeah.
right? I'm actively choosing to play a game where I'm going to, like, go into a fucking creepy-ass building and fight these fucking monsters and, like, whatever the hell.
Yeah.
I'm not going to choose to do that in real fucking life.
No.
I would never do that. It's about escapism and it's about, mm-hmm. you know, putting yourself into this fantasy situation.
Without any actual danger.
But I'm not actually going to be fucking scaling mountains with my bare hands like no. Link, you know, but I will play Breath of the Wild. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, you know. But Hardison, yeah, seems to kind of be missing the point of yeah. that, which is, like, you don't play a video game because you would want to do it in real life. It's kind of like the discussion we have a lot about Supernatural and, like, the Supernatural fans within mm-hmm. Supernatural and the way that they romanticize hunting as a mm-hmm. lifestyle when it's like, no, if this was your real life, you would fucking hate it.
It's a really fun exploration, especially going into the end of season 4. And, like, touching base and seeing how far the characters have come. And, yeah, like, I think, especially at this stage of the storyline, Hardison would be a terrible mastermind.
Mm. He's got a lot to
He's
learn.
Got a lot to learn, is really essentially what it is. And I think it's really interesting that at this point of the show, they're already starting to look at, like, oh, well, what are the characters actually capable of? And, like, at what point do their skills no longer give them sort of the prerequisites to do somebody else's job in the team. Mm. Because that's also another thing that I know the Leverage writers are really conscious of. They didn't want that sort of, like, you know, skill creep. They didn't want a hacker who was suddenly a really good, you know, thief and could pick locks, and, you know, and they didn't want a thief who was, you know, also an incredible grifter. Like,
yeah, like they're staying in their own lanes.
Yeah, while also learning some tricks of the trade for the others so that they're more, you know,
competent.
Yeah, yeah. Some more well-rounded criminals.
Oh, I have a bit of an update.
Mm.
Now, previously, yeah. I can't remember what episode it was in, but we talked about smart home technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking about my car.
Yeah.
And how it has this stupid feature.
Yes.
Where the button, right, controls mm-hmm. everything, but there's a manual key, but the manual key fits the ignition, but not the door. And I was mm-hmm. like, it's so stupid. I don't understand it. I have an update. And basically what happened was I was driving my nan around. She's like nearly 90. And I got out of the car and I went to get her out of the car. And my button failed and auto-locked my car. And now my nan is stuck inside my car and I'm stuck outside my car and my button isn't working. And so then I had to try and explain through the window, because my nan doesn't have a mobile, because why would she? She's nearly 90. How to unlock the car door from the inside so I could get her out. And then I was a bit like, well, fuck, because I can't lock my car while we're out anymore. So long story short, I take it to the locksmith to be like, hey, can you have a look at this and try and figure out what the fuck is happening? And it turns out that at some point before I got my car, someone had shoved a residential house key into the door lock, had turned it, and it had snapped off. But it had snapped off so far down that you couldn't see it without using specialist tools to get in there. So the key
does work.
So the key works now. I've owned this car since 2016. It's now
almost the decade.
Yeah. And it came to me like third hand. Mm. And this key has never worked. And then locksmith, maybe 5 minutes and $23 later, fucking fixed. And now my key works. So it was an update. It's not a flaw in the design. Some dumbass just tried to open the car with a house key. So my apologies to Suzuki. It's not your fault. It was, in fact, user error. Not even my user error. Someone else's user error. Anyway, I felt bad because we've released that episode now. I can't even ask you to be like, hey.
Can't even take it out.
Can you take it out?
Yeah. No, that was...
So I have to retract my previous statement. It's not a flawed design. It's just that someone out there is an idiot.
This episode, it's a lot of things, you know? I think it's a really nice, like, little respite because, as I've said, we're going into the pointy end of the season.
Yeah.
Like, I am so excited for you to get to the next two episodes.
I'm excited. I'm keen for the end of the season.
Yeah, it is. There is about to be a lot happening.
I'm not shocked because I was thinking that while we were watching, I was like, this episode's a vibe and all, but, like, where's the plot?
Yeah,
because
shit's about to hit the fan.
Yeah, yeah, like, I'm not shocked.
We've had set up for the plot. Like, it it does, in fact, logically make sense.
Excellent.
Where it's going. Like,
yeah.
It does come out of the blue because, like, shit's hit the fan, but it also doesn't come out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
So,
no, I'm excited.
I'm very excited.
I have a couple of rapid-fire points I might just go through, right?
Go for it.
So, number one,
mm-hmm.
the only, like, critique I really have of this episode is that everyone keeps bringing their golds to these people, which is, like, essentially cash converters, and then asking them, like, how much it's worth, and they're just assuming that they're telling them the truth point blank. I'm like, baby, I would be going to a couple of other jewelers to get it appraised before I just took their fucking word for it. Like, what are you doing? Like, that's maybe my only critique.
Key is predatory.
Oh, yeah.
The key is the people who are doing this are the people who are desperate, who don't necessarily have the time to, like, do multiple appraisals on this gold.
I mean, how long could it possibly take? Like, I understand your point.
Yeah.
But, like, if you're taking time out of your day to go to this one place, like, surely you can go to the jeweler down the road first and be like, hey, how much do you think that this would be worth? Because people do that all the time, get shit valued so that they can put insurance and shit on it. You know, so, like, it can't possibly be, you know,
it's also just difficult. Like, they're also preying on the lack of information and the lack of knowledge. You know what I mean? Like, this sort of business is primarily targeting a lower socioeconomic demographic.
Mm.
Like, they're targeting people who don't necessarily know not to trust somewhere dodgy shit like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we even get the ad. And I'm sorry, but if I personally saw that ad on TV, I would not go within, like, I'm not entering that fucking store. Like,
yeah.
God, to be sold, like, no.
Yeah, it's also,
I don't know. That is
a lot
questionable.
Mm-hmm.
But what I will say is that I know that she's like the villain,
mm-hmm.
but I low-key vibe with Barbara, who is like the sister of the pair. Like, I kind of love her. Like, the way that she's so knowledgeable on like all of this sort of like niche history stuff and like what I'm like, oh, you could have done so much good in your life and this is what you chose to do. Like, I just felt like her character was very fun. Like, she felt very individualistic in the sense of like, she didn't feel like a mark that we would have every week. Her brother did.
Yeah.
But she didn't. She felt specifically different and I liked that. And also I felt like, other than the fact that she was, like, being a terrible person and conning all these people, I feel like if she wasn't doing that, like, if she was just, like, a side character, would love her.
Yeah.
Also, there's, like, a scene where she's, like, looking at Sophie, and I was like, damn, she's, like, looking at Sophie. I only have a couple more notes. I'm just going to speedy through them.
Okay.
Number one, the apple juice. I don't really know why the apple juice itself was necessary. And also, what a fucking waste. Surely they could have just used water.
I think it's probably because it would have shown up on the camera better.
I mean, maybe, but, like, if you've got that much, like, it looks like water when it was on, like, the screen anyway. The only reason we knew it was apple juice was because they specifically showed it was apple juice. Like,
what would you have preferred they use for water substitute lube?
No, shut up. don't come for Supernatural in this particular instance, because that is a way, like, that is because they needed to show up on film.
But that's the thing.
Yeah, but, like, if you're gushing that much water, like, if you think about turning a tap on full pelt and it comes out basically white because of all the bubbles, right? That's essentially what we saw on the episode. It would have happened. Like, it's like a fire hydrant. Like, if you pump that much water at that velocity, it's gonna show up. Like, that's what it looks like water. Like, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know why they had
it's to meant to look juice. Like water.
Yeah, I know, but like, why couldn't they just use water?
I'm assuming because theoretically in the practical effects, water would not have shown up because it's like the black and white CCTV.
How is apple juice of any better option if it's black and white? It's like barely yellow.
Because of that barely yellow gives it more color behind it so that it will be more likely to show up on the film.
I mean, maybe, but they flood the floor under the door anyway. Like, I think it's kind of redundant personally. Like, maybe there is like a practical effects reason, but I'm kind of like, it seems like a pointless addition. I'm not saying it's necessarily bad. I'm just saying I don't understand it. And then the other thing that I was querying is why they still were desperately trying to get this specifically gold dust, which they've just watched, like, where the deposit is supposed to be completely flooded out. I'm like, guys, how much dust do you think is left?
Because I don't think it's just gold dust.
Oh.
Like, it's a stash of gold.
Oh, I thought they've the whole point was that it was, like, gold dust specifically. Did I just miss that?
I think the implication is that there is some gold dust because, of course,
there would be, yeah,
gold miners. But that it was a stash of gold.
Oh.
So, like, at least some of it had been melted down.
Maybe I just misheard it or something, but I was like, where is it going to be? Like, it'll be in the apple juice now.
I've never assumed that it was all gold dust.
Mm.
Personally, like, maybe I'm just reading it differently, but I always assumed that they're like, you know, they were like, oh wow, gold dust, that means there's gold.
Yeah, okay, sure.
But not that it was like an entire thing.
It's just because they just kept specifying gold dust, and I was like, is it just dust? Like, okay, sure. The other thing was that real estate agent expecting IT? Because Harrison walked in and was like, oh, it's IT, and he just fully, like, gave him his whole computer. Okay.
You missed it because we watched this together and, like, the little ad banner thing when I started it, you didn't get, like, the 5 seconds of context, which is like, oh, my computer's fucking up again on me, essentially.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Because I was like, okay, but why is IT that? Okay, so that's not my fault, though. That's, like, I didn't actually see it. Okay, cool.
No, that's, I thought you might have seen it, but obviously you just didn't. And because I know what's there, it's like my brain fills in the puzzle pieces anyway, but you don't, so.
And the last thing is that I did not even fucking notice Parker taking the necklace.
Mm-hmm.
That was so incredibly well done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hats off to everyone in that scenario. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, because sometimes I'm always like, I don't understand how pickpocketing, like, can actually physically occur. Because I'm like, surely you just notice. Like, surely, like, if someone touched me, I would notice. But, like, I didn't even see it. And it happened in front of me on screen in a media I am specifically analyzing. Like, whoa. Yeah. And it, like, normally when they do the flashbacks, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, yeah, I noticed that, blah, blah, blah. But, like, this time, had literally no idea. I didn't even notice she wasn't wearing the necklace throughout the... And I was like, holy shit.
It's the sort of thing where, like, pickpocketing works because they distract you elsewhere.
Yeah.
Because there's other things happening at, like... Yeah. So, typically, you know, if they're stealing your watch, they'll pat you on the back. Because then you're noticing the part on the back, you're not noticing the lightness on the wrist.
It's literally the, like, moonwalking bear.
Yeah.
Literally, it's that. And I was like, holy shit, how did I not see that? How did I not notice that at any point? They made such a deal of her with the necklace and putting it on and wearing it. Mm-hmm. And then she says, where did it go? Like, I don't even know when I took it off. And I was like, yeah, I don't know when you took that off either. And then they show it and I'm like, holy shit.
They stole start of the concert, even if anything else went to shit.
And it's not like, sometimes I like fault leverage a little bit because like they don't actually show the audience the thing that they did until the flashback. And I'm like, well, that's fucking cheating. Mm-hmm. But this time they literally did it in front of me.
And you didn't notice.
And I still didn't notice. And like fucking hats off, man. Mm-hmm. I like that 4 seasons in, they can still pull this shit. And I'm like, I had no idea.
Surprise Pikachu.
Yeah, literally.
And that's also, like, I'm pretty sure that would be something that Beth Reisgraf, the actress who plays...
Would have just done herself
because, like, they've said over and over and over again.
She's basically picked up the skills.
Yeah. When Paula Robinson come in, who was their sort of consultant for pickpocketing, etc.
Mm-hmm.
She's just weirdly good at it.
That's so funny. Yeah, no, but I thought it was impeccable. And it made me want to go back and rewatch it so that I could look to see her take it.
Yeah.
You know? So that was really cool. That was really, really cool. The only other thing is, goddamn, there was so much Microsoft placement in this episode.
It was everywhere.
So much.
Even on like the lawyer's computer when he was like, oh, da, da, da,
yeah.
It was like all Microsoft. Like they were like, oh yeah, even this computer that Hardison's just hacked is Microsoft.
I was like, damn. And I was actually literally like just talking to Naomi because we watched Glass Onion last night. And I was literally just talking to her about like, basically, if you see anyone in a film interacting with an Apple product, you can basically assume that they're a quote-unquote good guy because Apple has that whole thing about, like, villains can't use their tech. Yeah. But if someone's using, like, Microsoft or whatever, you can be like, oh, okay, so they're, like, the villain. Yeah. Like, it's more, like, likely.
Mm.
Leverage is so funny to me because Microsoft clearly is hardcore sponsoring them. And so it's, like, the exact opposite. I've never seen any other fucking product being used. Like, they've never had an iPhone or anything.
No. Every single character is using Microsoft products, whether they're a good guy or a bad guy. You can't ever use that because Microsoft... So basically what it is with Apple, Apple will typically lend product for product placement and also normally pay a fee for product placement.
Yeah, as you do.
In a film. But they will not do that. They will not lend product and they will not pay for any sort of product promotion if it's getting used by a bad guy.
Yeah.
So... if they are doing any sort of product placement in a film, the bad guy cannot use Apple products.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's not product placement, then it's fine. But then it's like, well, then the production would have to spend
their own money on Apple products. And who the fuck is doing that?
Exactly. When you consider like an iPhone is like $1,000. Yeah. Like if you've got, say, 8 main characters, all of whom are seen using a phone at some point, there's $8,000 of your budget gone.
Gone. Yeah.
It's not worth it for, you know.
No, especially when you're not getting anything out of it.
No.
Yeah.
So Microsoft obviously doesn't have that.
Mm.
They're like, whoever's going to use it, is going to use it. Like,
which is also like, in my opinion, makes way more fucking sense. Mm. Because if I'm watching a movie and I see an Apple product, I'm not, like, it doesn't matter if the good guy or the bad guy is using it. I'm still seeing their brand and that should be all that matters.
Yeah.
But anyway, it seems silly. But it was so funny watching Glass Onion because it was so apparent.
Yeah.
Because, spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen it, I guess, but literally all of the people were using Microsoft products except Blanc, who kept somehow winning iPads. I was like, that's so funny. Like, they explicitly were like iPad and iPad Pro. Like, they named them specifically and he kept winning them. And then, like, everyone else was using Microsoft products. I was like, that is so explicitly funny to me. Anyway, that was my last note.
Okie dokies. I actually realized I do have one final note, which is...
Hit me with it.
Actually, a line from Nate, which is, you do this long enough, you start seeing the worst in people. It changes you and not for the better.
Mm.
Which I think is a really important thing to point out of like, Nate isn't just stopping Hardison from running his own crew because he doesn't want to be a replacer. Like, that's not what's behind this. What's behind this is he doesn't want this to negatively change Hardison.
Yeah.
Hardison is a character who is so good, so moral, is, you know.
He's a little sweetie.
He's a little sweetie. And basically, Nate just doesn't want him to have to start seeing the worst of people. He doesn't want Hardison to have to put himself in that position.
Mm. Yeah, it's almost a protective role. And it comes back to that parental thing. Like, you know, we've talked about Supernatural a couple of times this episode, and I promise not to spend too long on it now. But it's a very much like Dean's thing whenever they interact with kids. Like, you know, we got it with Ben at the start of season 6, and he does that whole, you know, I could do what you do. And, you know, and Dean is so adamant, like, no.
Absolutely fucking
you,
not.
You will not follow this path. I cannot, in any capacity that I can stop you, I will, because I do not want this for you. I know how much I have dealt with, have struggled with, have been harmed by this life. I want anything else for you. And we see this like consistently with any of the young sort of people that Dean ends up being sort of like a parental figure or mentor to, or who he has a connection with. He does everything he possibly can to deter them from following the same path that he did. And so I kind of see Nate doing something similar here as a parental role towards Hardison. And it comes down to like another one of the things that I appreciate about the way that they framed their dynamic this episode.
Yes. It's not about like, oh, boo hoo hoo, I don't want to be replaced. It's Hardison as a character is a good person and he doesn't want to see that change.
Yeah. Well, it's also like Nate doesn't want, he's trying to protect him from the harsh realities of the world, I guess, you know, like any parent doesn't want, no parent wants their kid to have to deal with the fact that actually we live in a capitalist hellscape, you know, like.
I really appreciate this episode for like, I feel like this is the second half to the Scheherazade job. Like, I feel like we spend a lot of time in the Scheherazade job looking at, you know,
each individual team member's attempt at the con.
You're thinking of the wrong one. You're thinking of the Rashomon job.
Oh, for fuck's sake. They all sound the same. I know that, like, it's one of those things where it's, like, the style of the thing, but the way that every single one is, like, the something job confuses the fuck out of me. I cannot distinguish between
just
them.
Just ignore the and the job bit and just remember the words in the middle.
Yeah, but even that, like, the Scheherazade and Rashomon, I don't know these words from anything else.
It's like the Scheherazade job. I think of these two episodes as, like, bookends for each other. So in the Scheherazade job, obviously, we have, you know, Hardison being like, I want to do what you do. I want to run my own crew one day. Like, show me how you do it. Show me what you do. I want to learn. And Nate going, you don't have what it takes.
He just shuts him down.
You don't have what it takes to run your own crew. This is a bad idea. Like, let's not do this. And, you know, at the time, Hardison's like, I don't have, what is it you think I don't have? I'm the super scroll. I do a little blah, 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 blah. Essentially, this is what Nate's coming down to.
Mm-hmm.
Nate's coming down to, you don't have the experience. You don't have that sort of ruthless willingness to do anything behind it because you're not jaded by the world yet.
I think it's also a case of, like, it's kind of this funny mix between not being able to see the tree for the forest but also not being able to see the forest for the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it depends on at what point in the con you're looking as to which perspective it is. But, like, Hardison is spending so much time looking at the forest that he's not noticing what's wrong with the trees.
Yeah.
But, like, also, in some instances, he's looking so specifically at one tree that he's missing the rest of the forest.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, this interesting kind of perspective mishmash where he needs to find, like, a cohesive way to do both things, and he just doesn't have the experience to do that.
Yeah. It's, yeah, so for me, like, I think of this as sort of like, it is, you know, it is the logical conclusion to that, which is, as brilliant as Hardison is, he just simply doesn't have the, like, he's not jaded enough, essentially. He doesn't have the life experience. He doesn't have the same sort of ability to look at people and see only the worst things about them.
And also, ultimately, like, he is framing this entire thing as a game, but it's decidedly not a game. It is real life with real consequences. And you can't
manipulate it. It's not a perfect narrative. Like, a video game has a set narrative. You can't deviate from it that much.
No.
Like, even in games where there are different endings, there are only so many set endings you can get to and only so many ways you can achieve them. This is not like that because this is real life.
Yeah.
Anything could have happened at any point to upset the narrative. Mm-hmm. And it did. And so, yeah, he needs to be able to look at it from a realistic perspective and not from the perspective of
a video game. Here's this perfect narrative that I've laid out.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Okie dokies. Well, I think that actually is everything that I wanted to say today. Anything else to add?
No, I think I'm done.
All right, lovely.
Okay. Oh, no, I'm not. Their code names. Loved it.
Mr. Punchy. I have mentioned Mr. Punchy before.
Yeah.
I did have a moment where we were watching today and I realized this is the Mr. Punchy episode.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so funny because let's look at their names for a second. We've got Gold, mm-hmm. Silver, Mercury, Mr. Punchy. And did you see Hardison's name?
Yeah, it was
Hardy Man.
Hardy Man, yeah.
This man, I swear to God, I love him more than anything. It is...
The light of my life.
Yeah, but also...
Psycho.
What? Why is that your choice? Anyway, I do love the little, like, graphic animation things. I think it's really cute.
Yeah, I like that Elliot liked it as well.
Yeah.
Because really there's, like, two ways they ever go with Elliot and bits like that. It's either he fucking hates it and that's the bit, or he likes it and that's the bit.
And they did both bits today. Mm. He fucking hated it, and then he saw the graphic and he was like, oh, I fucking love it. Yeah. All right, lovely. Anyway, if that's all you wanted to add, that's all I've got to add for the day. How would you rate this episode of Leverage out of 5?
I give it a 4.5.
4.5? I'm loving that.
It's another one where I'm like, I hesitate to give anything a 5, mm-hmm. but I couldn't really fault it. Like, I had so few qualms with it. And
yeah.
Everything that I did really like, I thought was really, really well done. I thought it was nuanced. I thought it covered the topics it covered.
Yeah.
Fantastically and in a clever way and an engaging way. The episode itself was entertaining to watch. The pacing was good. Like, the, you know, costuming, we spent a lot of time talking about it today. The characterization was great. There were funny moments. There were intense moments. Like, I just think that it was a very well-crafted 45 minutes.
It was fun.
Yeah.
All right, lovely. The next episode is called The Radio Job. What do you think it's about?
Ooh, okay. Well, we've already had a radio tower this season, so I'd be surprised if they did that again. Radio.
Here's the thing. I just want to say this. Like, and I'm not saying you're correct or incorrect, but every time you're like, I don't know if they'll do that again, all I'm getting is, like, vampires. Flashbacks of me. Yeah. Like, yeah, but vampires are meant to be extinct. They're not going to do it within 4 episodes. Like,
They've done a lot with, like, we've seen them do it a few times across a few different episodes and a few different seasons where they have had radio, like, talk show hosts be part of the con. Like, they've called in to, like, report things and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking specifically of the season 2 finale where they're like, oh, the beavers are moving, and they're like...
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking about as well.
Yeah, perfect.
So...
Same page.
So I'm wondering if it'll be something similar. I think it would be really fun, actually. So fun if somehow the crew ends up being radio talk show hosts.
Yeah.
I just think that would be so fucking entertaining. Like, I feel like we've seen Hardison the weatherman. I would like to hear Hardison give traffic updates.
Yeah.
You know, I think that could be very fun. I think it would be really entertaining to have Sophie doing, like, relationship advice, you know? Like, you know those, like, early morning talk shows and they're, like, kind of cheesy and silly and, like, whatever. Like,
yeah,
I feel like it could be very fun to see them do that kind of scenario. I don't really know how it would work into the overarching plot because, like you said, we're coming up to the season finale. Mm-hmm. Like, the plot's going to hit the fan.
Yeah.
So I'm not 100% sure on how that would tie in.
Yeah.
But I just think it'd be a fun concept.
Mm-hmm.
The only other thing I can think is, like, rather than, like, radio transmissions, it's more about, like, radio communication.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they're tapping into, like, certain frequencies or, you know, they're communicating with walkie-talkies for some fucking reason, you know.
Glad to know we're on the same page. You're like, radios. I'm like, you mean, like, walkie-talkies?
Yeah.
And I was getting flashbacks to, like, the Cross My Heart job with, like... Yeah.
So, you know, I see it kind of going down one of those two tracks. Like, if I think of radio... My initial gut reaction is, like, the radio, like, AM, FM, like, whatever. And my second thought is, like, walkie-talkies.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put my eggs in those baskets.
Okay.
But Leverage has shocked me before, mm-hmm. especially like the fucking 15-minute job. And yeah. I was like so confident that it had to be a time frame without fucking thinking of the very common phrase.
15 minutes of fame.
So like I could be completely blindly missing something mm-hmm. right now. But those are my gut instincts. So I'm just going to go with those.
All right. Lovely. Do you have any ideas? I just want to ask this because we are going into the pointy end of the season.
Uh-huh.
How do you think this, like, do you have any predictions for how this plot line's going to wrap up? I mean, I know that you don't have a lot of information about it.
I really have little to go on. Like,
at the end of the next episode, you'll have way more information to go
I would on, hope so. So. Because it kind of feels like they're doing that supernatural thing where they give you the information at the very last fucking second. But I really don't have too many complex thoughts about it. I feel like any thoughts that I have had about it, I've already given in the relevant episodes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still kind of confused because the, you know, is it Latimer? No. Yeah.
Latimer's the one who bugged the office.
Yeah.
Who, you know, has that line about, you know, descending with your blood-tipped wings and like that. That's Latimer. Yeah.
I'm still kind of confused about why he suddenly seems to be in opposition to the team, given that he has previously made the excellent point of I would never bet against you.
Like that's about
it. It just seems like a dumb decision. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm still assuming that he's working with someone. I have an inkling that it's probably someone that the team has run into before, whether it's Chaos, whether it's fucking whoever the fuck else, you know. But I don't really have any more solid thoughts than that, because I don't think that. And I mean, to be fair, this is probably one of those scenarios where, like, looking back on the season, I'll be like, oh my God, they were putting it all there.
There are a lot of hints about who it is throughout the season, but they are very subtle hints. Yeah. They're more in like a, you know, like remind you about this random thing sort of hint.
Like the storm.
Yeah.
Da-da. But yeah, like, I think that it'll probably be something that I'll go, oh, okay, that was like, you know, they were foreshadowing it. But at this point, I'm not seeing, you know, any explicit connections.
Nope, that's all good. Okay, perfect. And if you want to interact with us at all beyond listening to us ramble on about Leverage for like an hour every week, you can find us anywhere you want. All of our links will be in the description below. We are terminally online, as the kids say. Talk to us about literally anything, but suggested conversation topics do include.
Have we asked people before about favorite costumes?
I don't think we have. I think we've asked costume-related stuff, but, like, yeah, what's your favorite costume?
Yeah, do you have a favorite look from each of the crew members? Mm-hmm. Or, like, do you have, like, a specific Nadine haters, like, you know?
By the time this goes up, we'll probably have seen to the, like, so unless it's, like, a season 5 costume, Beth's probably seen it. So anywhere up to the season 4 finale is probably safe.
I mean, to be fair, as long as, like, most of these costumes can't really be spoilery. Like, unless at some point I see Sophie dressed in a fucking, like, you know, ball gown or some shit. Like,
there are a couple of costumes that I'm thinking of. I don't know if they're necessarily going to be anyone's favorite costume, but there are a couple that I'm like, oh, that would probably be, like, a little bit spoilery to see in advance.
But if anyone has, like, a non-spoilery costume, and if you don't know, send it to Jamie and she can, you know, validate for me. But, yeah, I would love to see people's favorite Nadine Hayter's, you know, costumes or any of her work, or if she's worked on other stuff.
Mm.
Because I'm not actually familiar with her work outside of Leverage. So if anyone has seen her costuming in anything else and they think it deserves a shout out, let us know.
Yeah. I don't think I have anything to add to that. I like that.
Cool.
Perfect. Thank you so much for your time today. Have a lovely evening, morning, night, lunch, brunch, evening, afternoon. I've said evening twice now. That's too many times. Bye.
Bye.